Today I have with me Alan Abadesa Green. Alan is the founder and chief editor of SyncBook Press, as well as the founder of SyncBook Radio, both of which are outlets dedicated to exploring the mysteries of synchronicity and its more spiritually oriented counterpart, synchromysticism. Thank you for being with me today, Alan.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure talking with you today.
Starting off, before we get into the nuts and bolts of synchronicity, maybe you can tell us a little about yourself and the journey that led you to what's called the synchromystic community.
I guess just growing up, I had an interest in things that were strange. So some of this stuff has probably always been with me. But I also, at a young age, got interested in writing fiction and did that for a while. I don't know that I have a great skill for it, to be honest, but it's something I definitely enjoyed doing and did a lot of. And then I would say after 9/11, you know, living in New York, experiencing 9/11 and seeing how it shaped my city and the interpersonal politics, police presence on the street, it got pretty nasty. I definitely got more into conspiracy. I started questioning what were the real motives behind this, taking me into areas of, you know, police state. And I went down some very dark roads there. It was during this time, though, I mean, I spent a few years just really immersed in the conspiracy side. And then what very quickly happened was starting to notice, and anyone who's gone into conspiracy is familiar with it, you start going to this area where people start talking about the esoteric side of the conspiracy, that this is somehow ritualistic. There are, you know, these power elite are into occult philosophies, and that this symbol showing up during this event is evidence of such and such. And that's where things got to be a gray area for me. For one, I mean, example would be, you know, someone saying the idea of as above, so below, this is part of their philosophy. And I took issue with that because that certainly seemed to me to be a pretty reasonable and very ancient, very universal idea that the macrocosm and the microcosm reflect. So I didn't think that was really evidence of a conspiracy. And then it's the idea of symbols and symbolism and predictive programming. And when I started hearing people talk about predictive programming, it's where my fiction background really helped me have some perspective on that. Because if I look at stories that I wrote leading up to 9/11, there were what, again, if I was a member of the UN, people would be calling it predictive programming. It was very much foreshadowed, in some cases explicitly, in what I was writing. There's also evidence of esoteric narratives. I wrote this one story, which once I became familiar with Kabbalah, I realized I had written out this very, very archetypal story from Kabbalah of the Atom Kadmon in this story that I wrote in the late 90s. And I realized this is not, and there's evidence, and we'll get into this throughout the show, but there are cases people do this intentionally. For example, Guy Ritchie made a movie called Revolver, which he used Kabbalistic Tree of Life as the framework for his movie. He states this very explicitly. This was something he did intentionally. But there are so many other cases of this happening unintentionally, and I can speak from personal experience of this happening unintentionally. I mean, I was as surprised as anyone else. And once I realized that what I was writing was just as, for lack of a better, it seemed to reveal knowledge of this material as anything you might see in Hollywood, and that you could find Hollywood movies, you know, you could have the most mainstream professional thing that we might associate with elitism and all this stuff and the mainstream, but there's also really independent works. I worked in the comic industry a lot of independent comic artists, and I could look at their artwork and go, these are guys I know are not familiar with any of this stuff, and yet I can see this same material in theirs. It leads us to the question of, where does intentionality start and stop? What is the collective unconscious? Where are these ideas really coming from? And there is a community that I stumbled on that studies synchronicity, and there is a community that call themselves synchromystics, which they focus more on where media and mysticism overlap. This is exactly where I had a big question mark in my research, and I just started diving into their material, developing ideas, and we would all just kind of, you know, it's a loose-knit community, but we're all pretty niche community when you consider how big the internet is. So a lot of us were familiar with each other's work and would talk about it, comment on each other's blogs, write articles, discuss ideas. And this just was such a healthy and wonderful alternative to what I was hearing from people screaming, this is the truth. And if you don't handle, you know, if you can't accept my truth, you're one of the sheeple. And I'm thinking, yeah, but are you so sure about your truth? I feel like before I can get behind your truth, there's a lot more I need to investigate. And this just took me in this whole other direction. After doing that for a while and experiencing this community, I one day just had an idea. Hey, what if we all wrote, you know, roughly 10 pages and we put that together, we could have a book. Just thought it might be a fun idea, a fun project to do. I do enjoy collaborative artwork. So this was just something I pitched to a few people within the community, and that quickly snowballed. People started sending me stuff. I realized we had a really fascinating book coming together, and I reached out to a few more people, and that became the Sync book. Just 26 different authors, not all consider themselves synchromystics. I think that's an important distinction. Some people actually have a major issue with that term, for lack of a term, that school of thought. There are, within this community that's studying synchronicity, there are, I guess, like any, I don't want to say religion, but, you know, like any sort of school studying esoterica end up with different kinds of branches of that, of people who lean more towards one thing or the other. And this is probably true for, as we discussed before the call, this is true with, you know, quantum physics and any science, any artwork, any spirituality, you end up with sort of people who are a little more specific and cluster. So I don't want to lump everyone in under the term of synchromysticism. And it was actually important to me to have people who had issues with synchromysticism to keep it balanced and keep distincting views in there. So we did the first sync book. It ended up doing pretty well. We were still selling that book. I still hear amazing feedback on it. Granted, this is only 2 years ago, but in terms of a book, that's actually pretty impressive. This just has continued to snowball, and we realize, hey, you know, if we all, when we all put our minds together, we actually come up with something pretty damn fascinating. And everyone said, well, you know, we should do more things like this. And I was kind of just the guy who will not sleep and will do some of the heavy lifting to bring these things together. So I don't think of myself, it's weird. You know, I had someone say to me on Facebook something along the lines of, was like the godfather or granddaddy of synchromysticism. And I'm like, no, I don't think that's true, because I actually came to this game pretty late. I'm just the guy who's trying to facilitate all these artists and all these thinkers who I really greatly admire their work. I want to share information and their work to a bigger audience because I just think it's so valuable. That's how SyncBook Press and SyncBook Radio all kind of came to be.
SyncBook 1, I read, I think, last June. I haven't had a chance to read SyncBook 2, but a number of the chapters from SyncBook 1 stay with me to this day, and particularly your entry where you discussed some artwork you did in your youth and writings in your youth, and how that seemed to reflect both a future trajectory for your life, but also some kind of future events. And it doesn't mean that you're claiming to be some kind of clairvoyant. It's just showing that this subconscious, whether it's localized in our brain or external to ourselves, it's there. And it seems to be that time and space and everything exists now, and we're able to be conduits to a degree to put that out into the world. So that whole idea, I had a vague recollection of that and a vague concept of that being in touch with some of Terence McKenna's work, where he would often say that the world and everything you see around you is a language and it's up to you to interpret it. So in a way, he was already talking about synchromysticism without giving it a word, and really just drawing on indigenous, what I would call indigenous literacy, where many Native American cultures, etc., they would, you know, read the landscape, or they would listen to the vibrations of the animals to know where they are, and all this stuff. So it's kind of a reclamation of, some people don't like that archaic revival term, but however you want to refer to bringing back, not abandoning technological society, but bringing and reincorporating certain sensibilities from indigenous cultures that served them so well and that we seem to be lacking. So I thought that was very interesting. That has definitely stayed with me. And I can also see what you're saying, that these things just kind of materialize themselves in your art, in reference to my brother, because he's an artist, and he's really in no way in touch with conspiracy or any of the esoterica, but he has like a small band he does on the side, and he draws some of their cover art and so on, and he would send it to me, and it would, you know, it would be like a pyramid without a capstone, and there's a beam coming out of the pyramid, and this person like being sucked up in the beam, almost like an alien abduction. So there's all these juxtapositions of heavy imagery that if someone saw his artwork, he'd be like, oh, he must be in the know. But as someone who knows him, you know, he's pretty clueless when it comes to it. So again, if these things just come out, whether you intend for them to come out or not. And so I think there's a lot of value in the book, and a lot of different perspectives are presented in there. So you're not just getting beaten over the head with one person's ideas. So you can find a flavor that's good for you. You gave a very pretty good explanation of Sync and synchromysticism, but maybe you can give a more concrete example of applying synchromystic techniques to either interpreting, say, a movie or some kind of real-world event, whatever you think is appropriate.
If we could just back up for a moment there, let's take a look. What is synchronicity, right? Synchronicity was coined by Carl Jung. It's these coincident events, these things which are two or more events occurring together. Yet there's this idea of a correlation between the mental state and the external environment. So here we have your brother making something out of his mental state, his artistic space of whatever symbols were speaking to him at the moment that he associated with the music, etc., etc. And here we see a correlation with the external world of how your interest and the interest of many people, these topics and these symbols, that these are incredibly powerful symbols for entirely other reasons. You know, some people taking this stuff very seriously, correlations between alien abductions and pyramids and things like that. So there's certainly, in that example, that would be a good case of a mental state correlating with an external event. But I guess like a more common example of a synchronicity would be, hey, I'm thinking of a friend I haven't seen in 10 years, and then bump into them at the supermarket while I'm driving through Ohio or something. And okay, why was I thinking about this guy? And then I actually meet them. Not only is this a synchronicity and a correlation between an internal mental state and the external environment, but then you have this non-linear aspect. Synchronicity, Chronos being the god of time in Greek mythology, you have this idea of it's occurring together, but occurring together in time. Here we see that there's sometimes an almost skip in the record of how it would work. You weren't thinking about him because you just saw him. You were thinking about him before you saw him. Is this precognitive? And as you said, I'm not claiming to be a clairvoyant at all, but what I am claiming is that there are so many examples of people having this experience just before or a day before or something like that. That's why I say like a guy like Anthony Peake, he has a chapter in Sync Book 2. He does a lot of work into deja vu, precognition, things like that. And to me, have to combine synchronicity with this kind of studies because this is the very nature of synchronicity. So it's almost a non-linear aspect to it that appears again and again. You asked for an example of how synchromystics might apply this, and you gave me the example of something I did recently. If people are interested in a more in-depth version, they can go to thesyncbook.com/synchronize. I did an episode of a new radio show called Synchronize, where I gave a pretty introductory overview of all this stuff. It's a more in-depth, but basically, a synchromystic might look at a piece of artwork, what's movie. Now we're going to treat this movie almost like a shared dream, since synchronicity is so personal, and very often, if I relate to why it was so powerful that I ran into this guy in the middle of Ohio, it makes for an okay story, but doesn't really strike you. You don't have the same context. So synchronicities are kind of hard to share for that reason, personal synchronicities. So very often we go to something that we can share, that we can have a common context, and it might be a world news event, a movie. And sometimes I like to say we can almost treat them like a shared dream. Watching a movie is almost like a, you know, living through a dream. And this is like, hey, we have the same dream. Let's talk about it. One of the things I'd like to hit on, if we have time, is what would be the perhaps downside to using media? Because media, obviously, we have, especially if you're coming from a conspiracy mindset, you're going to say, well, this media is controlled. These people are in the know, or at the very least, there's a whole committee of people working on making sure that the set design and the script and all this sort of stuff. So media, of course, has too many variables to be perfectly scientific. And nonetheless, it's a pretty good, sometimes I feel like it's as close as we get in studying this to a scientific experiment, a repeatable form of synchronicity. I go back and forth on that in my mind. Some days I think it's the perfect scientific experiment, and then I go back and forth and think, no, this is terrible, there's many variables. So until we could find something better, we'll talk about media. So you might watch a movie, and you could watch this movie through a number of different lenses. And this stuff is basic film criticism, or stuff you might have learned in, you know, an English class in high school. They're going to say, hey, here's the surface, and then what do you think the author was really trying to say here? What were they using, any symbolism? I remember reading The Grapes of Wrath in a high school class, and the teacher pointed, did you notice that the preacher, his name, I would say the name escapes me at the moment, his initials were JC. Teacher saying, think the author was trying to imply a connection to Jesus Christ by making the initials JC. And that sort of stuck with me through the years. At the time, I was like, well, is that stretching? What is that? And then you realize that there are plenty of examples of people trying to encode certain symbols. And I think at this point, when someone is watching a movie, we can say, oh, that's the Jesus figure. This is a very common thing people will say. Oh, that's the Messiah, or that's Jesus figure in this movie. It's such a commonly used symbol that even people who aren't creating artwork recognize it as an archetype that artists will intentionally use. Once you start opening your mind and your, for lack of a term, your vocabulary, and start learning more archetypes, we can look at things like Tarot. Tarot gets just labeled as this new age BS thing, or that it, you know, people are just using it for divination purposes and it's a parlor trick. Well, the true value, at least for myself and a lot of people I know, is not, none of us are trying to use it for divinatory purposes. It's a catalog of archetypes. The whole reason why I actually think Tarot could work for divinatory purposes is because it's saying, this is a catalog of all the archetypes that could be emerging. This represents almost like a periodic table of elements. This is one of the shapes that space-time can take, that a moment can envelop these characteristics. So that's why Terence McKenna was so interested in the I Ching as part of his time wave concept. The I Ching is the same thing. This moment in time seems to encode these concepts. So these archetypes, these characteristics, and these type of event. Well, again, we don't have to use them for divinatory purposes. We can just start to learn that for thousands of years, people have been paying attention to time, just as in the Western world, we pay attention to how an object traveling at this speed seems to pick up this velocity, and we're able to figure out how, we have a pretty good idea how gravity works, how momentum works, and all this stuff. Well, in the East, they were paying attention to how does time work and how do events unfold in time. If we look at these systems, we start to get a different appreciation of archetype and moments in time. Well, when we take that same lens and apply it to media, you see that artists aren't just using the Jesus archetype. they're using a whole host, that there are esoteric stories being told in multiple layers throughout every piece of media you might watch. And the million-dollar question here is, how much of it is intentional? Chris Knowles, he's a writer who writes at the Secret Sun blog. He actually has said, perhaps better than saying, is it intentional or unintentional, he posits that we should say, is it conscious or unconscious? And I think that's a really interesting and valuable take on it. So if we take this lens, we can start to say, so here's the surface narrative. Here's some, for lack of a better term, intentional symbolism that the author might have used. For example, you know, saying J.C. as the preacher's name. Then we can start to see, well, some stuff goes so deep. Did the author actually have awareness of some of the archetype they were using, some of the motifs that were in their book? And again, from personal experience, I can say there's so much of it that just comes from this other, for lack of a better term, unconscious space. So this happens all the time. Then we might go a step further and start incorporating synchronicity into that, or crossover. We can start to see, did the same actor in this movie, did they also play a similar character in another movie? Now, again, this is not the perfect science, because there are evidence of what we might call typecasting. This is a very common thing we all know. And yet there reaches this whole other level when you go deep with it, is that it's almost like there, some people have jokingly called it archetype casting, where the same actor plays the same archetype or finds himself in the same environment, the same location, the same shooting location again and again and again. Whether this is intentional or not, I think when you start making it across multiple movies, across multiple directors, and the bigger the actor's career is, you start to see how unconscious this really is. I think the true test of this, though, when we step outside of the media and you start having personal synchronicities, if you watch a movie, or let's go back to Grapes of Wrath, you're reading Grapes of Wrath and you haven't picked this book up in 15 years. Let's say I haven't read it since I was, well, actually I have, but for this example, I haven't read it since I was in high school. And because someone mentioned Grapes of Wrath to me, I'm like, oh, you know, I liked that book. Let me go get it. I go to the library, grab a copy of Grapes of Wrath. I come home, I sit down, I start reading it. And my wife walks in and says, hey, I just came back to the supermarket and they had a sale on grapes. Something along those lines. With now personal synchronicity, that's not probably the most profound example, but the overlap here would be, okay, I just had a personal synchronicity with someone saying grapes. Here I'm reading this piece of media that I haven't read in a long time. I'm thinking about this J.C. Jesus archetype. And then perhaps at that point, realizing that the very idea of grapes being associated to the Jesus figure, right? His blood is his wine. What's wine but grapes? Jesus being an agricultural god in many ways, his body being bread and his blood being the wine or the grape juice, essentially. You realize that all these things kind of overlapped in one moment. And if you, there are what I think that skill of a synchronistic mindset to this sort of stuff would be, you know, you're sort of almost recognizing that all of these levels are true in their own way at the same time. So there is a time and a place for a surface narrative. There's a time and a place for looking at intentional symbolism. There's a time and a place for looking at unintentional symbolism. There's a time and a place for looking at what we call composite characters, how these characters might up again and again in the same actor's repertoire. Then there's a time and place for looking at how personal synchronicities interact with the media. And then what I kind of like is an all of the above approach, being able to see all of these different tunnels, reality tunnels at once, and having an appreciation for them on an individual level as well as what they create in total. And again, if someone wants to hear a sort of longer version of that, a more thought out version of that, check out Synchronize. I believe it's the episode where I interview Ray Dawn Chong, and I have a longer version of that.
Yeah, that's really useful. That gives definitely a framework for people to work in. And building off something you were just talking about, how you have this conscious and unconscious casting in movies or music videos or something, you also seem to see this play out in politics too, which I've heard referred to as theater or acting for ugly people, which I think there's some truth to. So you see the same kind of themes playing out in politics as well. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, it doesn't have to be media. For a lot of the guys that I work with, they prefer to look at media. I'm still an old school conspiracy buff and political junkie as much as I very often don't want to be, because it's definitely the uglier version of it. And yet I kind of can't help it. So you can apply this to anything you're interested in. If you're some guy who's really interested in music, check out your favorite bands and start looking at, you know, your favorite guitarist happened to play a track in some other band's song, and what was the album art for that, and et cetera, et cetera. And you can take this any direction you want. If you're interested in politics, if you're interested in movies, if you're whatever it is, I guarantee you can apply the same kind of skill set to that. So for myself, I like to look at politics. And this, of course, comes with the same kind of variables, particularly for someone who's aware of political manipulation and someone who very open to a lot of the conspiratorial takes on things. You start to wonder, well, it's intentional or not. You know, you look at like the 2012 Olympics in London, where the lighting for the stadium were giant illuminated eyes and pyramids. And it's like, well, okay, that's someone playing with intentional symbolism, right? You know, it's like, some of these things are really in depth. And at the same time, when you really have an appreciation and understanding for how synchronicity works, the reason I really focus on this idea of an all of the above, when going back to that example, that all of these things are true in their own way, is so helpful for looking at symbolism in politics. Because I know it's a big field right now for conspiracy buffs love to point out eyes and pyramids and things like that. But what you have to realize is that if you really do understand the way synchronicity works and how often this stuff comes out so perfectly that it would seem planned, you have a question mark on a lot of what we call truth, particularly that the conspiracy crowd says this is a truth. We're the truth movement and we're going to give you the truth. We have to put a question mark on some of that. Nonetheless, just as someone could intentionally use symbolism in a movie, someone can intentionally do this in politics. So, for example, in the Iraq War, when we invaded Iraq after 2001, when they called their campaign Shock and Awe, well, there is, in Jewish mysticism, there is what's known as the Shekinah. This was basically the female version of God, or the God on earth, the power of God on earth, how Yahweh would appear in his earthly aspect. And this was what the Jews had in the Ark of the Covenant, and that this was a weapon that they could use against their enemies. So when the government goes out to fight and calls their military campaign Shock and Awe, is that an intentional play on the Shekinah? And I would think it probably is. Particularly since you have, there's a whole host of things we could discuss with just that example, is that Saddam Hussein considered himself a reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar. He actually had giant mural commissioned that would portray him as Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was taken out by the Moabites, and the U.S. military developed during that campaign, developed what they called the mother of all bombs. They used these bunker buster bombs to attack Iraq, which was called the mother of all bombs, or the Moab for short. So here you have the Moabites taking out Nebuchadnezzar, and now here the U.S. military using the Moab to take out, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's reincarnation as Saddam Hussein. So these things are like, well, is this intentional? Is this, what is this? When you get really deep with it, it just raises some really interesting questions. I'm not coming to you with a hard truth. People who are claiming this is intentional are wrong. What I'm saying is that when synchronicity happens, it happens so perfectly that you think this has got to be planned. This is why people often give a religious answer. This is God. There's some grand architect who's structuring this entire thing. The researcher John Lilly called it ECHO, ECCO, the Earth Coincidence Control Office, that he thought there was some sort of discorporate psychic entities that were controlling all of the coincidences on Earth. And there's a million and one explanations for how this happens. But when it happens so perfectly that your first reaction is always like, am I on candid camera type thing? Like, where's, who's making this happen? But when you realize when it happens on a personal level that only you could understand what your personal mental state was at that moment, that you're the only one who would know what you were thinking, and then someone walks in the room that you haven't seen in 10 years, you were just thinking about them, only you would be able to coordinate that, or higher entity if you wanted to go that route, which is, I guess, why a lot of people take the mystic route, is trying to figure out if some higher control, what is that? And of course, there are people, I have people in the Sync Book Volume 2 who take this very Gnostic idea that there are archons, or then you have some people who take a religious aspect, it's God, or some people, I'm sure there are people out there who this is their guardian angel, or, you know, a million and one terms for basically what is this thing that actually knows what I'm thinking and could make this coincidence happen. There's also a more solipsistic answer, is that you're manifesting your own reality. You and I both share an interest in quantum physics, is kind of how we got talking, and you probably know more about it than I do, but say, for example, the double slit experiment, where we see that the observer affects, in a very literal way, affects the reality around them. Well, if this is true, did my thinking of my friend bring him into this place where I was? Am I in a weird sort of way manifesting this guy I haven't seen in 10 years? So you can take a more solipsistic point of view on all of these things, again, just raise some really, really interesting questions, but it's all in the same phenomenon. And it's really why I did the Sync book as having so many different authors, because everyone has kind of come to a different answer and their different perspective on the same phenomenon. And yet, very often, I think, you know, maybe we end up raising more questions than we do answers, but that's okay. That's really healthy, because I think it's important for us to realize a lot of things we take for granted as truths. There's a lot more, we should throw a question mark back on a lot of the stuff we take as hardcore truth.
I completely agree. For me, Sync, I see it as having validity for a number of reasons. One, there's too much meaning associated with these kind of coincidences to be written off purely in a sterile scientific manner. Like, there's a domain of science called networking science, and they say they can explain all the coincidences based on nodes and number of connections and so on. But that's ignoring the qualitative aspect of it, and just because they don't have an answer for what consciousness is, they can just say, well, it's just your brain is manifesting these things through a chemical process, and there's nothing more to it. So meaning has no significance in that framework, and so it's dismissed. But for most of us, I think we search for meaning as human beings, and it's important to us. And so to just write it off as that, it's not delusion, but it's a deep recognition that there's a qualitative side to life that can't be chopped up purely to numbers or even to what we would term rational. There's this extra rational side to the human experience, both our external and internal experience, and it's about reconciling those two things. So, like you brought the double slit experiment, we're not creating that reality out of nothing. We're not making our own reality. We can't. It's not like The Secret, which I think is totally delusional, where, oh, you just have to imagine it and it's going to happen and you're going to have success. I think that those kinds of ideas let people down and then provide kind of easy fodder for critics of that kind of thought process, because it's selling empty promises. But when we recognize that there's both a conscious side to life, where our mind is part of the system and we're interacting with it in a very dynamic way, but also understand that there's an external thing that we're dealing with that is very mysterious, and that there's this interplay. So there's both a duality and unity working hand in hand. So to say it's just one or the other, and then the polarizations and the conflict that arises from that, it's like you said, it's people are shutting themselves off from certain reality tunnels, and seeing them all at once is really the key to all this, and letting it guide both your actions, your intuition, and so on and so forth. So I don't know if you agree with that, or any sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I would take it a step further, is why I'm really emphasizing the all of the above thing. I used to, for a while, I had the question in my mind, is it this or that? Is it conspiracy or is it sync? Is it intentional or is it unintentional? Is it conscious? Is it unconscious? And I can't, it's both. It's both. There's an interplay there. And now I've kind of come to a point where I'm saying, well, it's actually like five different things at once. You know, forget it. Well, it's this and that. It's like this and this and this and this and this. You know, when you consider that like I said, the secret is saying, if you just think about it hard enough, if you wish and you sprinkle some pixie dust on you, you'll get that car you want. So if you want a car, well, part of it is that, yes, you're going to focus your mind on it. And then you're also going to go out and get a job, and you're going to start working for it and saving for it and getting the things you want. And guess what? In a few years, you've manifested that thing you want. But it took both your mental state of focusing on it and being disciplined and saying, yeah, this is what I really want, and I'm going to make sure I get it, and I'm going to work. But then the physical side of, I'm going to go out and work for it. And this is, I think, why I take issue sometimes with the guys who are more, I hate to say this, they're almost too spiritual, just think that, you know, it'll all magically happen. And then you have the people who are way too much into just hardcore materialism that think like, well, there's nothing to this foo-foo consciousness stuff. Well, no, I'm sorry. It's both. You need to combine these two examples. And my example of that car is a little crude example of like, hey, just think about it, work hard for it, and you'll get it. But ultimately, that's a pretty practical version of what we're talking about. When we talk about an event like 9/11 or the invasion of Iraq, then you start realizing, well, there's what the U.S. military wants. There's what Saddam Hussein thinks, what I think, and what consciousness I bring to it. There's the media spin. There's the actions of soldiers on the ground. External world events are going on the world stage that might mirror or influence that event. And this is why when people go too much into conspiracy, just as someone might go too much in, to me, that's the same thing as going too much into materialism. You're saying, oh, well, obviously all these things are connected. That means there's some grand Illuminati overseeing the whole damn thing. And to me, that's a really limited vision of the world, because you're telling me that there's only 13 people in the whole world that are controlling everything. Well, I'm sorry. Don't buy that. At any moment, and actually what synchronicity shows you is that even when you're aware of it, how little control you have, and at the same time, how much control you have. I want people to feel empowered. Same time, don't feel so empowered that you're going to sit home twinkling your toes trying to get, you know, a sports car. I think that's silly. But nonetheless, feel empowered. It's the Illuminati does not control everything. The CIA does not control everything. But yes, they have a role to play. And that in some cases, they are going to try and do something intentional. For example, let's take the CIA and the Illuminati out of it. Let's just go to a simple marketing executive. Hey, I want to sell you a Kit Kat. So, okay, I'm going to make a TV commercial, or I'm going to put a product placement in a movie, and I'm trying to get you to buy a Kit Kat. What you can't control is what's happening in the room at the same time. What happens if, you know, your four-year-old son has the flu and keeps vomiting? And he just vomited up something that looks like the most disgusting version of a Kit Kat you've ever seen when Kit Kat commercial. I guarantee you that show's not going to work. You are now going to have a mental association of, ooh, that's something I don't want. They can't control the personal synchronicity of what was your mental state, what was your external state as you were watching that commercial. In very much the same way, the CIA might try and manipulate a country that they're trying to invade, or a country that they're trying to seize control over, including our own, and yet they can't control the mental state of the person who's receiving that propaganda. They might influence artists or be able to control certain media in many, many ways. Yes, we do see that there is a massive amount of media consolidation and control. Nonetheless, they can't control the inspiration of every artist that they work with, especially if artists seem to be much more in tune to this unconscious realm or this non-controlled realm of ideas. They certainly can't control so much of that stuff. So it's when you realize that you have personal power, that your mental state, and just realizing that they don't control everything and that you control, you're just as much of a valuable variable in this giant human experiment we call Earth as they are, that you can be empowered. Same time, I am weary of someone getting too solipsistic, too wishful thinking, that they think it's all them. You have to remember that it is this and that. It is you and what you bring to the table, and yet there are about 7 billion other people on the earth who are bringing their consciousness, their hopes, their dreams, their intent, both conscious and unconscious intent, it's all happening once.
That's very interesting. Like you're saying, Sync and what Sync helps people do is, again, to become empowered, because that's so lacking in our society. People either put on a facade that they're empowered, whether they project through their jobs or other kind of cultural roles that they buy into to alleviate the internal strife, so to speak. And so you can either buy into the hardcore materialism and be like, well, look how much money I have, look how many toys I have, I'm valuable. Or you can either take that, again, that too extreme mystical position and be like, well, matter is sinful, matter is lower, matter has no consequence, so the suffering of this person doesn't matter because it's just karma or something like that. So you can abuse both of those ideologies that are extremes to basically dehumanize people, or to ignore pain, to ignore your own pain, and then ignore like happiness and what the meaning of life is. So Sync and synchromysticism, it provides, there's many paths, I'll just call it the third path in this case for people to follow in terms of that. It's grounded in pattern recognition, but at the same time it's grounded in the idea that we don't have ultimate control, but we have some control of our inner landscape and how we filter the outside world. And I think Neil Kramer talks a lot about that as well. Okay, so if you don't mind me just moving on a little bit, sometimes you hear, again, spirituality is inherently evil, or spirituality will lead to some kind of theocracy. How do you see spirituality? What purpose can it serve in our life? Does it have to be dogmatic? Can it be flexible?
Yeah, I think spirituality has a place. I think it's something that we're hungry for and we're missing in a lot of ways. And then it's so easy to see how that gets abused. I think your example of people ignoring the plight of others, it's something I do see a lot in the more sort of new age community is, well, I'm just going to focus on myself and I'm going to change the world myself. And I'm going to sit here and kind of making myself happy, and that improves the world. And it's like, well, do you have no compassion for the person whose their house is getting bombed, you know, in the Middle East? To me, I think compassion is very important. Now, I don't want to be dogmatic about that, though. I'm open to those guys' approach because, you know what? There are, if we want to get real about this, there are schools of thought in the old school Eastern Enlightenment traditions. There are some schools that think compassion is really important, and some people who say compassion is the final stumbling block towards enlightenment. So I realized that someone, you know, hey, I could be wrong. I like to be compassionate, but hey, maybe that's a stumbling block. It certainly sucks to be compassionate, but I think it's my natural instinct and I'm comfortable with it. It may not be the easiest path, but I'd still like to care about the plight of others. But just to say, absolutely it should not be dogmatic. I think that's the whole point, what synchronicity is kind of showing us, and particularly our brand of synchronistic study, is showing that, hey, if we all sit down and watch the same movie, you saw something different than what I saw, and our other friend saw something completely different. And all of these perspectives were valid in their own way. So in the same sense, what might be spiritualism to you and what might be your life path might not be mine. You know, we could take this to areas of set and setting, the sort of classic psychedelic thing, but very much applies to the psychedelic nature of the world around us, that so much of it is based on personal perception and what you're bringing to it. So to me, the dangers of spiritualism is whenever it gets dogmatic. Dogma is the danger for any political ideology or spiritual ideology. And I see this in politics. It was one of the things that really turned me off to conspiracy world as it stands right now, is you have a few very strong voices within that community who are saying, this is the truth, and I'm going to tell you the truth. That's no different than the Pope getting up there and saying, I'm a messenger from God, and I'm going to give you the truth. I'm going to give you the word of God. Well, I don't think Alex Jones is speaking the word of God, and I don't think the Pope is speaking the word of God. There's very little difference in those positions. If someone gets dogmatic and says, this is how it is, and I've got the truth, I'm going to tell you how it is, that's very dangerous. It's one of the reasons why, at least ideologically, the classic idea of the Illuminati, I'm incredibly sympathetic with. You know, for everyone so scared of the Illuminati, it's like, wait a second, these were guys who wanted to take down the kings and the theocracies. I'm down with that. I'll go on record saying right now, I am down with that. I do not want ruled by a theocracy. I do not want to be ruled by a monarch. I do not want to be ruled by anybody. This is the power of sync, realizing that you can kind of shape your reality and yet also appreciating that other people have theirs. So don't be dogmatic. Don't preach your truth to everyone. And at the same time, don't just buy someone else's truth. To me, if we can find this sort of, as you put it, third path spiritualism, I think that would be just wonderful. I think we are so hungry for it. Every time I speak to someone who claims to be atheist or just this, you know, modern person where it's almost taboo to say anything spiritual, they all go, well, the universe or God, whatever that is. It's like everyone doesn't know what to call it and everyone's like tiptoeing on thin ice. I think we all want to feel this connection that we inherently do feel. We do feel connected to something, but our modern culture is so afraid to voice it. We're afraid of sounding like some dark raving evangelical. And at the same time, those dark raving evangelicals are pretty dangerous. So it's all balance. It's all about balance. That's what synchronicity and this whole path that I've been on the last 3 years, it's what it keeps showing me. It's like, understand there's a time and a place for spiritualism. There's a time and a place for practical materialism. I've given the example, if I want to move a chair from one side of the room to the other, I might be able to go to a monastery and spend 40 years studying power of my mind that I could move a chair from one side of the room to the other. Maybe that's possible. Maybe, you know, telekinesis is possible. But if that takes 40 years to move that chair, or I can just get up off my ass and move it with my bare hands, there is a time and a place for practical, physical, 3D reality and materialism. I think we have to balance these things. It's really important not to get stuck in the body, but not to forget the value of the body, to not get stuck in the head, but still appreciate the value of the head, to not become flighty. You mentioned Neil Kramer. Neil Kramer uses the expression woo-woo space bunnies. It's a really silly phrase, but it pretty well characterizes some of the people that I've met. We don't want to get so lost in the fifth dimension that we're just kind of walking around in this flighty, flaky space. And at the same time, if you never explore, it would be like human civilization starts out, hey, here we are, we're on the land, and we're all in one place. Someone's got to go out and explore. You have to go out and explore the jungle. You got to go out and explore the ocean. We got to go out and explore space. It's what we do. Well, as mystics or psychonauts, as Steve Wilner calls it, we are exploring mental spaces. We are very much explorers, and just as someone who goes out into the jungle could get eaten by a tiger, someone who goes out into the ocean could get swept away by a big wave, someone who goes into mental spaces and explores these alternate perceptions can get caught up in that and end up being the fakiest, spaciest person you've ever met. So it's not without its dangers, but I think if we can stay from being dogmatic, if we can stay open. Henrik Palmgren does Red Ice Creations. He has this expression, keep it mind, but not so open that your brain falls out. I love that. This is balance. This is the practical spirituality that I think we all really, really need. And just be respectful of other people's, what speaks to someone else and might not speak to you.
I'm glad you brought up Henrik, because I would say he was probably my gateway into more of this world. And he caught my attention just because he approaches these topics with such a balanced approach, and the seriousness and his knowledge base is so admirable. He's very much like a modern polymath, and he doesn't just become a compartmentalized intellectual that can only, you know, talk about their very truncated area of expertise. And so in that sense, he serves as definitely like a model to follow. Let's see. And yeah, I have to comment on this idea that culture is telling us that everything is figured out. I know for a long time, I was not a curious person well into my 20s. I didn't read, I didn't think, because really, even if you survive a public school education in the Western world, it really does kill your curiosity. Because when you take a science class, it's like, Here's the periodic table of elements. Here's how molecules form. This is it. This is how the universe began. There's no debate about it. There's not even a dialogue about alternatives. It just communicates, again, this idea of what the truth is without saying, well, here's alternatives and here's how to be a critical thinker and to recognize patterns and to use that in your life to come to your own truth. So we're so focused on endpoints and not the process itself. Like you said, anyone that wants to explore is often criticized or told that they're being unscientific, even though most people who say that don't even understand what science really is or what the culture of science is like. Say string theory or delve into quantum physics a bit more. It's very, very esoteric and very much grounded in philosophy and not empirical evidence. There's more in common with these realms than we like to admit because we're so compartmentalized.
It seems to me we're at this weird sort of tipping point that it could go one of two ways. You're either going to get this major schism between the hard, you know, this sort of class, you know, fundamental materialist, the religion of science that says we've got it all figured out, don't question anything, God is dead in that respect. And then you have the other people who feel so threatened by that, they go all the way to the other side. And I went to this place in, I don't know, it was like Tennessee or something. It's called the Creation Museum. And it's basically these people bending over backward, trying so hard to defend that the Bible is literal and saying, well, this could have happened while possibly trying so damn hard. You have people feel so threatened that they have to defend their dogma and they're going to bend over backwards and completely throw any rationalism out the window, trying so hard to defend that position. And the scientific materialists do the exact same thing. They'll throw out data because, well, it doesn't fit in our model. They just say, it's just a coincidence. Oh, well, it turned out that way when you, in this, and there are experiments we can do for precognition, psychic states, all these things. And they just want to throw that science out because it doesn't fit into their model. So there's this real, I feel like there's a point where either we just have this major schism between the two, which we're really seeing right now. And at the same time, I'm also seeing this whole new crop of people who are figuring out, wait, we can combine these things. There's a value to science, value to mysticism. There's a value to art. I consider synchromysticism is those three things. And if we can bring these things together, if we can find a place that they actually all fit together and see what is the value, what does science teach us, what does spiritualism teach us, what does philosophy teach us, what is the value of art and how that speaks to us. If we can, instead of having this major schism between them, that it's got to be this or this, if we can start to bring these things back, I do see a crop of amazing new researchers, many of whom you'll see on Red Ice or in the alternative media, who are actually bringing these things back together. And to me, that's so inspiring. And, you know, while I have this sort of fear of, oh boy, I hope it doesn't go completely break apart this total schism, I'm very much rooting for the unity coming back.
Yeah, I'm not totally of the opinion that we have to like merge science and religion and make them one thing, because I don't think that's what the aim is. But in recognizing the validity of both, we see that they're not mutually exclusive, and in ways they reinforce one another, not necessarily prove one way or another. So I don't think we're advocating, oh, we have to turn into this one monolithic belief system where we merge them and they both lose their current identities, but it's about balancing
certainly
them
not,
out.
Certainly not. So yeah, take it back to what I was saying at the beginning, is like when you watch a movie and you can see that, well, this is true on this level, there is a surface narrative here, boy meets girl, blah, blah, blah. There's also this. All these things are true on their own level, and if you can understand that they all have their time and their place and that they're all valid in their own way and create a sort of synthesis from that, it's like, are we individuals or are we all one? The answer is yes. You know, yes, we're all one, and yes, we're individuals. Should science and religion find some common ground? Yes, but I agree with you. It doesn't mean you want to create the modern church of gobbledygook.
I guess in wrapping up a little bit, maybe we can get into what you're currently working on.
Sure. I am working on a book right now, Two Suckings, which really goes into laying out how archetypes and synchronicity and these symbols emerge. And I'm picking, you know, probably the most controversial subject. I'm basically doing a quasi-synchromistic analysis of the JFK assassination, 9/11, and the quote-unquote killing of bin Laden by the Navy SEALs, kind of showing how these three events are so inherently connected and are expressing the exact same narrative, and how all the weird synchronicities that these events seem to attract, and trying to say, yes, these are loaded, loaded events that, you know, who killed JFK? That's not what the book is about. I'm not trying to argue for a specific theory of who did it. What I'm trying to argue is that, just as we said, it's not mutually exclusive. Whether it's the CIA or Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone, or it's the mafia, or whoever pulled that trigger or multiple triggers, it don't, for my study, it almost doesn't matter. I'm just looking at is to say, yeah, there's a lot of been done there, but what about this whole other angle? And I know that some of that work has been done with 9/11. It's kind of what inspired me to do this. Again, I see so many people saying, look at these, what are essentially archetypes. They're saying, look at this occult symbolism in 9/11. Well, yeah, absolutely. 9/11 is crazy loaded with occult symbolism. But those buildings, the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, are themselves occult symbols. And the questions start to come, are they, because they're giant, essentially, talismans, are they attracting these weird events? Is this being used as part of some sort of mega ritual? Or is this synchronicity? Or is this conspiracy? And then the other stuff's coincidence? Or is it a little bit of all of the above? And I'm kind of just going through these events and breaking down some of the symbolism, some of the weird synchronicities that seem to attract to these events. In some cases, saying this here, I think, is a straight up conspiracy or intentional or conscious use of symbolism. This here seems to lean more towards synchronicity. And ultimately, I'm not trying to argue intentionality, unintentionality. I'm just trying to lay the data out. I do definitely give some opinions, or if I think it leans more one way or the other, but I'm just trying to lay the data out and show that there's a lot more gray areas than a lot of people who approach this stuff would think, whether that's someone, again, who takes the mainstream idea of, oh, it was Lee Harvey Oswald, or you're some hardcore conspiracy theorist who has your opinion of what it is. I'm trying to show that there's 37 other perspectives and other angles to look at these events through. And it's really, to me, the value of it is not to muddy the waters. I don't want to muddy the waters from a political vantage point. This is something I was talking about with James Corbett. Was, you know, how many people say, oh, it's just a coincidence that they were running a drill that day, or it's just a coincidence that such and such happened, you know, just a coincidence that there were all these put options placed up on the airlines. I'm not trying to muddy the waters and say, oh, all of this is a coincidence. What I am trying to say, though, is that our truths are kind of muddy. And certainly when you really look at it with a skilled eye for this kind of thing, and particularly an eye for how synchronicity plays out, you got to start to wonder. I'd like to end with my friend and co-host for Synchronize, Andras Jones. He did something, he was on the show, and they were talking about how perfectly lined up synchronicities seem so intentional. And he said, yeah, and how do you look at that and not think about 9/11? How do you look at that and say, and the guy was like, what do you mean? What does that have to do with 9/11? He's like, because when things line up so perfectly, you automatically assume it's intentional. And yet synchronicity shows us very often that's not the case. And again, this is, I want to be very clear, that's not to argue that, oh, 9/11 just kind of happened in some weird cosmic event. It's saying, yes, there's intentionality on behalf of multiple people. Yes, there's symbolism being used, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. And yes, there's straight up synchronicity, but no one is aware of this. And I don't care how intelligent you are, how much you've planned out your, you know, whether it's 9/11 or JFK or whatever you've decided you're going to do, synchronicity always seeps in. I'll leave you with two quick examples. The Sync Book Volume 2, I've just put structuring these chapters in a way that I thought it kind of created a flow. Hey, I have some people who are more into science, some people who are more into the mysticism, some people who are more into conspiracy, some people who are more into the artwork. Let me kind of space these out in a way that kind of flows naturally for a reader that I think would be a useful for a reader. I ended up with Scott Onstott. I don't know if you're familiar with Scott Onstott's work, but he basically wrote a chapter about the value of pi, or the importance of pi, and his chapter happens to start on page 314, which pi, of course, is 3.14. When that happened, I laughed. I did recognize it, but that wasn't intentional, and I laughed, and I was like, oh, that's perfect. Ha ha ha. Funny end of story. Well, Scott Onstott was just interviewed on 42 Minutes, another Sync Book radio show that I produced, and they interviewed Scott Onstott, and I didn't realize that he's talking about the importance to him of the combination of numbers 327. Well, his chapter, and then they point out to him, his chapter ends on page 327. Starts on 314, ends on 327. Even if I wanted to intentionally put Scott on page 314, which I'm saying I did not intentionally do that, I didn't even know that 327 was important to him or was relevant to him, that I would have planned that out. So this is an example of not only does it happen without you planning, I couldn't have even, my unconscious couldn't have even planned it because I didn't even know it at the moment. Since we talked about Henrik and Red Ice, I will plug, I'm actually going to be on Red Ice in the next few weeks. We're recording that show on Saturday. I happen to be listening to Red Ice. I have this personal repeated synchronicity with Sirius. It's the star Sirius and the symbols attached to it. I have this really strong connection to it. And just recently, again, I found myself, I was trying to write about it, and I was saying, Chandra, what really is my equation to Sirius? Well, you know how Red Ice works, where they start to announce their upcoming guests. They'll say, coming up, we have interviews with such and 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 such. Well, I'm listening to Red Ice, and I hear my name. The first O where he announces that I'm going to be an upcoming guest is an episode with this guy, John Greer, Stephen Greer. I think his name is Stephen Greer. He's a UFO guy who made this documentary, which he is all about Sirius. I'm sitting here pondering, what is my personal connection to Sirius that it keeps being a reoccurring synchronicity for me? And here I am listening to a guy talk about Sirius, and then at the end of it, they say, coming up, we'll be speaking to Alan Navidessa. Again, just this weird correlation between me and these things. Does Henrik know that I have this connection? Did he do that intentionally? Possibly, but I doubt it. Henrik doesn't strike me as that guy. So again, it's all these things where you can say, gotta be intentional. Well, not always. If I can leave you with anything at the end here is to say, throw some question marks on some of your belief systems. You can always come back to your belief. The nice thing about belief systems, you can always come back to them. But if you can open your mind a little bit, explore some of these question marks, explore some other reality tunnels, explore some other perspectives, I think it's the healthiest thing we can do. And so I'm not trying to say anybody on a specific ideology, a specific belief system. I'm just saying I've encountered so many really interesting question marks that it's made me question every belief system I've ever had. I'm at a point where I've just become a lot more flexible with it, a lot more open to possibilities of what may be, rather than being so sure I know what it is. If people are interested in more of these topics or learning more, then we can kind of get here in about an hour. Please go to thesyncbook.com. There are two volumes of sync books where people can get 52 different authors' takes on this stuff. It's not just my take on it. If they go to the website, we have three different podcasts that we do, 42 minutes, always record, synchronize, or three different shows that we produce. And if nothing else, go to the website and click on the authors tab. There are links to all 52 authors' websites, personal blogs, and you can kind of get a taste for who people are and what they're doing. It doesn't cost you a penny. The podcasts are free. The links are free. Just check out some of what these people doing. I think it's such valuable work. If you're into science, if you're into spiritualism, or you're into being an artist, doesn't matter. This is the space where all of these things converge and or at least are explored. So if you're interested in any of those topics, I think there's something there.
And I'd encourage anyone that visits the site, obviously it's all free and it's open source, and that's a tremendous model, and I have a lot of respect for that model. But at the same time, people are free to donate. And really, it's not that you're asking for handouts, it's just a really excellently produced product. And quite frankly, it's just a way of showing appreciation if you liked it. And if you don't like it, don't donate. Alan, thank you so much for a really interesting conversation.
Oh, absolutely. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate all your input. And it's just been great talking to you. So thank you so much for having me on.
Yep. So all the best to you. And hopefully we'll do this again in the future.
Fantastic.
All right. Take care.